This is the Freeman Report with James Freeman on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Hello and welcome to the second hour of today's Freeman Report. It is Wednesday, the 17th of April, 2024. I'm your host, James Freeman. And if you've just joined me, I've been discussing the situation in Gaza and the West Bank with Mohammed Barakat. He's a second generation Palestinian living in Jerusalem. As a child, he was an eyewitness to the Six-Day War in 1967 and later went on to become an executive committee member of a trade union in the West Bank, and later a guide for Green Olive Tours, where he explained the cultural and political situation of Palestinians were facing to tourists. I thought he did an absolutely brilliant job, actually, in telling us what it's actually like really on the ground for Palestinians. The fact that I didn't know, in the West Bank, for example, there are different jurisdictions. And even though it is all Palestinian territory, you can't just move freely from one city to another city. You've got to go through checkpoints. And at times like now, or when security is heightened, you quite often can't get through. So this is within your own country, right? You can't travel freely. Israelis are controlling all of the security there. He also talked about the fact that there are three categories of Palestinians in Israel with different rights. Some of them can't go into politics. There was so much, actually, we did talk about, but so much we didn't talk about as well. So much so that I'm going to try and get him back on the show in the next couple of weeks, because I'm actually fascinated to hear this, because, you know, the politicians are still talking about a two-state system, about Palestine getting its own state. I think that's baloney. I just don't think it's possible. Mohammed actually agreed with that. He said that there are now around 750,000, somewhere around there, settlers on Palestinian land. How do you solve that? It's an impossible task. You cannot get rid of those people now. There's just too many for the Israeli government to move on. So I think the two-state solution is dead in the water. And the more I talk with Mohammed today, the more I think apparent that became. So we're going to get him back on. But if you do want to watch today's first hour of the show, then it'll be uploaded in the next couple of hours. Just go to tntradio.live and you'll be able to download all of my recent shows. You better listen if you're in the car, or watch on your phone or your TV or your laptop, however you want to view the show. Right. OK, so coming up in the next hour, we're going to stay in the US. I'm going to be talking to US defense and national security analyst Brandon Weikart about the unfolding situation in the Middle East. Although I'll be asking him also to unpack an article that he wrote for the National Interest, where he claims that America's greatest enemy isn't China or Russia, but it's actually the $35 trillion in debt, the national debt in America, the $1.65 trillion deficit this year, $1.65 trillion deficit in government spending, and the $1 trillion in interest payments on that debt. Quite astonishing figures there. And, you know, many, including myself, believe this is why America is, having this proxy war with Russia. It's why potentially the world is a much more dangerous place at the moment, because when countries are backed into a corner and their economy is collapsing, well, the quite a common way out of that is to go to war. So we'll be talking all about that in a moment. My second guest this hour is Raja Mia. He's been on the Freeman Report before to talk about grooming gangs in Manchester and the corruption and cover-ups in the councils and the police, covering up all of those crimes going on. Raja is planning to stand in the general election in the constituency of Oldham, West and Royton. I think he's brilliant. When he came on the show recently, it's clear that he is fearless in his pursuit of justice and accountability for the crimes that have been committed. His activity has put his life in danger. There's no doubt about that. But he is determined to make a difference. And his work seems to be paying off as, you know, if we just look at Oldham Council, for example, Labour used to hold 47 of the 60 seats in the council there. That number is reduced to 31, so they've only got a majority of one now, which means the upcoming local elections could see Labour lose control of that council. We'll therefore be discussing those local elections and also what Raja is doing for the general election. So really interesting stuff there. Now, before we go over to our UK news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news, listen up, because there is an awesome music festival taking place in the last bank holiday weekend in May. We've already talked about the Speakers Festival in the first bank holiday of May. Well, this one is in the second bank holiday towards the end of May. Stand in the Light UK Music Festival is being put on as a collaboration between a Stand in the Park, that fabulous organisation that helped people during the pandemic, and the Light newspaper, another fabulous organisation. The music festival will include 30 awake artists, including Danny Rampling and Mobius Loop. An all-night acoustic fire pit. I think that's where I would be, with a big bottle of something there and a few smokes. A bouncy castle. Hope Sussex will be there for the children, plus loads of amazing stalls and food vendors. The festival will be taking place in the beautiful Lake District in the UK between May the 24th and the 27th. Now you get 4 days of camping and full access to the whole festival for just £60 plus a booking fee. And children under five go free. And that makes me think of the days, actually, back in the days, I'm sure many will be familiar with this, when, you know, you were seven or eight and your parents would be like, you know, pretend you're five, or getting into Longleat Safari Park and being hidden under blankets in the back of the car. Anyway, I diverge. Under fives go free, but I'm sure they're going to be checking that. But what a great festival. So if you want to get more information reserve your ticket, go to standinthelight.uk, standinthelight.uk. And if you want to get in touch with me, email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation, there are lots in there now. There's about 80 people in the chat room. Get yourself over to tntradio.live and click on the chat icon. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk TNT.
Going 360 on the headlines.
It's really well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, over to Gemma Cooper, our UK news correspondent for today's breaking news. What have you got for us, Gemma?
Well, now, since we last spoke at the top of the last hour, I've been checking out some betting odds. Just quickly, I thought, you know.
Well, for those people joining us now, remind them of what we're talking about here.
So we have a little bet between us now, don't we? With our own kind of wager of a meal out. Whoever loses has to pay for the meal out. But David Cameron will be the next Conservative Party leader. I still have got my money on the fact that not only will he be leader, he'll one day be Prime Minister again. Having heard him deny that he wants to do it, that means in my book, he wants to do it. So we've got this bet. You don't think it'll ever happen. I think it will happen. So the latest odds of Cameron being the next Tory Party leader with one betting organisation in the UK is 20-1. The favourite is Penny Mordaunt. But last year, when he returned to the political stage, 16-1 of him being PM were the odds being offered, which are no mean odds, actually. It's pretty good. So we'll see. I'm just throwing it in there, James. I've just been doing a bit of research, doing my own research on this one, because I'm quite competitive and I do like to win, in case you hadn't noticed.
And by the way, it's not just a meal. It's a meal at a Michelin star restaurant. I think that's really important to make sure that is fully understood. How many Conservative MPs, you might or might not know this, are ahead of him in terms of the odds, though? You mentioned one there.
Yeah, there's quite a few. I mean, let's have a look. I mean, Penny Mordaunt's the favourite at the moment. And then Kemi Badenoch, she's after two women there at the top of the list. Alen Suella is mentioned. So she's 6-1 at the moment to succeed Rishi Sunak. And then we've got James Cleverly. He's at 10-1. Robert Jenrick, he's there at 12-1. So Nigel Farage and Cameron are both 20-1. But you said that Farage could actually be coming back. So there we go. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that Cameron could be coming back too. Both 20-1 at the moment.
Gemma. He's not going to be the leader of the Conservative Party. They might be offering 20-1, but you know that he's not going to be leader of the Conservative Party. He's yesterday's Tory party, unless something really weird happens this year. But if, like I said, the Tories get smashed to bits, which I think is banked in now, is baked in, I think that's going to happen. Then there's going to be a whole kind of debate about what we got wrong. You know, we've gone off the path of conservatism, all of that kind of stuff. And the only route from there is a move to the right. And David Cameron is not that. So I'm sorry, Gemma, you're just wrong on this one.
I'll say on air what I said to you as we came off air just an hour ago. I know things. I'm something of a witch. I'll leave it there. We'll leave it there.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, if you are right, I'll chuck in a bottle of champagne as well if I have to fork out. So anyway, Gemma, what's going on in the UK at the moment?
Well, I don't drink champagne, darling, so you'll be all right on that one. What's going on in the UK since we last spoke is quite an interesting story. Now, I would never normally bring celebrities to the table here, you know, the kind of mainstream celebrities, because here at TNT, we're not bothered about all that. We see it for what it is. But interestingly, Hugh Grant, obviously very famous actor, he's just settled his privacy case against the publishers of The Sun newspaper, tabloid newspaper here in the UK. He settled a case against the owners' News Group newspapers. He said that even if he could have proven the allegations in court of unlawful information gathering, phone tapping and targeted burglaries at his home and office to get stories on him, even if he could have proved all that in court, if he'd won but the cost didn't match up, he could still have been facing a legal bill of 10 million. He says he didn't want to face a legal bill of 10 million, even if he won the case. So he settled out of court, which means that News Group newspapers don't have to appear in court and prove that the allegations that he's making, which they've always denied, but they don't have to come to court and prove it. So effectively, they have bought his silence. He said he's been offered a huge amount of money, which he's going to give to various press privacy charities. He's not going to take the money. He says it's got a very nasty smell to it. But it's just, I think, an indication of why the mainstream is still so powerful. They've got a huge amount of money to buy off, not just Hugh Grant, but other people bringing privacy cases against them. Prince Harry is also doing that as well. I'm not bothered particularly about the royals, about celebrities. I'm bothered about the power of the mainstream media and the way they still go about controlling narratives via money. So that's quite a big headline here. That we just touched on this at the last hour, the Conservative conference in Brussels, where Nigel Farage was speaking yesterday, and it was stormed by police as he was on the stage and shut down. It's since been reopened. A court order has overturned the decision of the mayor, who said in the interest of public safety, he wanted it shut down, and it was far right. That's back up. That's a piece of good news for us. And also, this is a sad story, but indicative, I think, of what's going on in the world. One of the UK's best-selling authors had just confirmed on her social media account she has a very aggressive form of brain cancer at age just 54. Sophie Kinsella, who's very famous for her Confessions of a Shopaholic series of books, which were made into films, says she was diagnosed with glioblastoma, a very aggressive form of brain cancer, towards the end of 2022. This does rather echo this growing trend of young people being diagnosed with strange and aggressive forms of cancers right across the world. And also, James, I don't know if you felt this, but there was an explosion in South Wales earlier, a few hours ago, in the UK's only ammunition factory. That was in South Wales earlier, and police and fire crews have been there for some time.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't feel the explosion, no. Whereabouts in Wales is that?
That is, if I just let me check what's up on my screen.
Is it near Usk? Because there's a big, I think.
It's in Monmouthshire. It's the BA Systems base in Glasgow. I don't know how to pronounce this. It's a definite Welsh name, this one. Glascoed.
Yeah, that's. I'm pretty sure that's right near us. There's a huge munitions underground. Well, it's supposed to be kind of secret, but it's kind of not store there. Oh, right. Okay. Well, what's going on at the moment? Are they put out the flames? Is it contained or?
Emergency services were called just before 11 o'clock this morning. Incident occurred at the BAE systems, an explosion within the building. All the emergency services were called. So that would be fire, ambulance and police. So there's an incident control post set up and it's the biggest military contractor actually with several sites across the UK. Yeah. But it took over, it says, the plant from the British government in the 80s and produces ammunition for arms and small arms, medium caliber weapons, mortar bombs, tank ammos and artillery shells. That's all the details I've got at the moment. Obviously, 10 to 11 this morning is when it happened. And now the details are being kind of filtered out into the public domain. It does say the explosion occurred within the building, so it doesn't necessarily mean it was a targeted attack. It might have just been a piece of equipment that went wrong, or, you know, yeah. Or we don't know. We don't know what the cause of this is yet. Then no one's mentioning terrorism or anything like that, just an explosion with an incident room set up.
Okay, thank you for that, Gemma. I will take a look on the news. It's probably, about 20 minutes from here. I might even go for a ride on my motorbike, see if I can see anything later today. So thank you for that, Gemma. Look forward to speaking with you again tomorrow. To the rest of you, don't go anywhere. We've got another packed hour for you. In a second, I'm going to be joined by Brandon Weikert. He's a US defence and security analyst. Going to be asking him about the Middle East, of course, but I'm also going to be asking him about an article he wrote where he says America's greatest enemy is the $35 trillion of debt, the $1.65 trillion in the deficit, the government deficit. That's a huge number of big hole in government spending in the US, and the $1 trillion interest payments. Brandon thinks that is the greatest enemy of America. So we're going to talk about that right here in a moment on TNT.
Sonia Poulton.
Since 2018, I have been documenting and making a documentary about the issue of transgenderism. And because the fact is, when I happened upon it around 2016, 2017, I literally could not believe what I was being told that I must believe. And that is, first and foremost, that there is some sort of anomaly of nature that enables some people to be born in the wrong body. Of that, straight off the bat, did not make any sense to me whatsoever. And then I could clearly see what was happening, that men were going into women's spaces and taking over women's spaces, such as sport, in all manner of places, in politics, and it really alarmed me. But nothing alarmed me so much as what was happening to children.
Sonia Poulton
on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation.
It really is that simple.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, we're going to be talking about the Middle East first, because my next guest is a US defense and security analyst. His name is Brandon Weikert. Welcome to the Freeman Report, Brandon.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brandon, tell us, without me kind of leading you down any kind of roads and asking specific questions, give us your assessment of where we are at the moment with the Middle East conflict.
Well, definitely we saw a significant escalation. There's a couple of takeaways, one of which has sort of been touched on in the media, but not really sort of appreciated, which is that on top of the obvious US-UK sort of joint mission to stop the hundreds of Iranian missiles and drones, you also had the inclusion of Jordan and Saudi Arabia and some other Sunni Arab countries, indicating that the Trump administration's Abraham Accords are not dead, despite how hard the Biden administration has been trying to kill them, which probably helped to prevent this thing from really escalating into the world war that I fear we are teetering on the brink of, at least for now. The other takeaway real quick is the fact that Israel basically is now having to figure out what they're going to do in terms of escalation. They won't be able to escalate, though, because they weren't hit the way that they thought they were. So we might have some time now where some kind of negotiated settlement might be had.
Okay, on that first point, Brandon, are you saying, tell me if I'm correct in assuming what you said there. So you're saying that the Arab nations surrounding were actually shooting down the missiles along with the UK yes. and America?
Yes, in fact, there's okay. Queen Rania, who's been very critical of Israel, apparently got into an F-16 and was shooting down these incoming Iranian missiles herself, which I did not know. That's the image on Twitter, at least, that she was in a plane when this thing happened. So clearly there is a real understanding by the Arab states. Look, we may not agree with Israel on what they're doing in Gaza. We don't want to see the Iranians, though, escalate. One other thing, though, to remember, Iran attacked a nuclear power, Israel. Okay, everybody knows, even though they've never acknowledged it, that Israel has nukes, and Iran still did this attack, which is kind of scary when you consider that normally non-nuclear powers don't attack nuclear powers because of yeah. the fear of reprisal. So my article recently in the Washington Times was all about how, even though this was a successful defense, Israeli and American deterrence have clearly failed because Iran felt they could still do this. And so that also is an issue that we're going to need to contend with.
Yeah, I mean, that was my big takeaway with this whole thing. The message that Iran was sending to Israel, that rather than, you know, we were going to do you loads of damage, it was more a statement of fact that we are not afraid to attack you directly from right. Iranian soil. That was the message that I took from that. I've kind of assumed that based upon the language running up to the attack from Iran and the government there, that they didn't want to escalate. Okay, so I think the fact that, you know, yeah, okay, it was 300 drones and whatever, but I think, and I'd like to hear your thoughts, but I think Iran knew full well that the kind of attack it was launching would really do any damage. What are your thoughts? Would you agree with that?
They probably had to know on some level this wasn't going to work, but I think they were probing. I think this attack was actually probing with fixed bayonets, pushing forward, hitting mush and stopping when they hit steel. I think this was a probing attack. I think they were trying to understand just what exactly the Americans were going to do in response. And now they know the Americans, despite Biden's rhetoric, still will intervene on some level on behalf of Israel. But the question in Tehran has to be, how far would America and its allies go to protect Israel? Iran's already said they've reserved the right to restrike. And it might not come in the form of a conventional missile attack like this last one. They have a lot of terrorist proxies. They could conduct some kind of massive terror attack a la, October 7th.
The other thing that I've contemplated, and I don't really know an awful lot about sort of military assets and how many Israel have got and whatnot, but it strikes me that there was a hell of a lot of drones which have been shot down. Presumably they've used their ironclad defense system. And, you know, has Israel got an endless supply of missiles to use? What is the situation there? Because it strikes me that one way to attack Israel would be to overwhelm it with sort of drones which it needs to shoot down. Right. And then, of course, it runs out of missiles at some point.
That's exactly. So this is why I was saying I don't know how ineffective the Iranian attack would be in the long run if they keep doing stuff like this. I think you're right. Basically, the entire Western defense industrial base, we're seeing this in Ukraine, it's broken. We're not able to produce the kind of armaments that are needed for all of these new conflicts. And ultimately, I think you're onto something. I mean, we see China doing this with Taiwan, where they're constantly overflying Taiwan, trying to strain the equipment of Taiwan's military. Every time Taiwan has to respond, that puts wear and tear on their planes and equipment. And so similarly, Iran is not stupid. They're very smart. They're a very strategic power. They are aware that they have limitations, but they're also aware that Israel has limitations. And yeah, eventually Israel's going to run out. And oh, by the way, I said this before. We say in Florida, even a blind pig can find its slop bowl once in a while. And I think that could be true of Iran. They might get lucky one of these times. And by the way, one of those missiles might not be just conventional that they shoot over. Eventually, they might start lobbing nukes over.
Yeah. Yeah, because Iran, a lot of these drones now, you know, they're being shot down with missiles which cost millions of pounds a time. These drones are very, very low tech kind of technology, which can be produced for thousands of pounds. So presumably, you know, you just overwhelm the system until the point that it can no longer function. And that is then when the real attack comes. So I'm glad you agree with me. I don't think this attack was the failure that a lot of Western politicians are kind of saying it was. I think there's much more to it than that. Brandon, we're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'd like to get your take on the political stance of the Biden administration towards Iran, because leading up to the attack, I think that the language was very soft. It was kind of because obviously, you know, Israel attacked the consulate in Syria, Iran's consulate. It was very, very soft language from the Biden administration in terms of, well, if you do attack, please do it in a way that's not going to escalate things. Iran said, we're not going to escalate things. But now we're actually hearing now that messages coming from Janet Yellen that they the US might even take sanctioned policy against Iran and their oil exports. So for me, there's a lot of mixed signals coming from the Biden administration, because on the one hand, they were like, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with any Israeli attacks against Iran. And Iran, if you do attack, just make sure it, you know, it's not going to escalate. Whereas now the US is coming out and saying, no, we're going to impose sanctions. So I'd love to get your take on that right after this short break on TNT.
Great news.
Good news, everyone.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. After helping defend Israel against an Iranian attack, the US says it will not offer the same level of protection to Ukraine.
Different conflicts, different airspace, different threat picture.
Israel's been accused of killing near a dozen children in a drone strike in central Gaza. Much of the desert city of Dubai is underwater after receiving 2 years' worth of rain in a single day. And the FBI has launched a criminal investigation into last month's deadly bridge collapse in Baltimore.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
So, Brandon, as I said, I'd love to get your take on what is going on with the politics coming out of the Biden administration towards Iran, because as far as I can see, it's all over the place at the moment.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And we saw this also, by the way, in the run-up to Ukraine, where Biden at one point sort of said on the eve of the Russian invasion, well, if you're going to take the country, just take a small sliver of it. I'm paraphrasing. but you know, this is sort of the double-handed or the double talk that Biden has become a master of, partly because I don't think he's really mentally there. And I think that confuses the situation, and it sends the wrong signals to America's enemies on the eve of them getting ready to make a very big move. And I think you see this now with Iran. We know that Biden wants to continue with the nuclear deal started by Obama. We know that Biden has been meeting, or his people have been meeting, with Iranian diplomats behind the scenes to try to restart talks as early as 2 weeks ago. They were meeting with Iranian diplomats. And yet this is happening where, you know, America's intervening on behalf of Israel. And I think the issue now is we do not have a political leader in Joe Biden who can be decisive, who can be clear, which is what clarity is needed. And I think it's actually exacerbating the crisis. Now, I don't agree with the Iran nuclear deal, But it would be nice if we had a president who could speak clearly and say what exactly our objectives are. And if we don't know what our objectives are, we probably should take a step back and reassess.
Exactly. This is exactly the debate I've had on the Freeman Report this week, whereby, you know, quite often we don't even, you know, I mean, let's compare him to Trump. Trump would be on our TVs talking every day. And whilst you might not have agreed what he was saying at that specific time, he was always very, very clear and very decisive and very, very strong. He projected power, even if you didn't agree with how he was wielding that power. With Biden, well, they daren't let him on the TV because they don't know what he's going to say. Right. So all we get is these White House statements saying, you know, this stuff, and it tends to be wishy-washy and change. I agree with you that I think that that whole thing in itself is making this whole situation much more dangerous. Now, Brandon, do we know yet whether Iran have got nuclear weapons? Well, obviously, we know they've been trying to develop them.
Well, the official U.S. intelligence assessment is no, but that's ridiculous. Of course they do. The question is what level of complexity do they have? Their complexity may not be that great. Now, their ballistic missiles are very complex, but the complexity of the nuclear armaments themselves, for instance, I don't believe they've had miniaturization yet. The North Koreans can miniaturize these warheads and put them on top of ballistic missiles. Iran's not quite there yet, but, you know, they're growing. They're growing that weapons capability every year. They were doing that whether or not the Obama era nuclear deal was in place. It's a mission of the Iranian regime since 1980 to get nuclear weapons. That's a year into the rise of the Khomeini regime. So this is something that is almost part and parcel of the Iranian regime, and they have a handful of them. They're rudimentary, but they can still do damage. And by the way, I've been tracking since 2022 these bizarre Iranian uranium shipments to their proxies. One happened in November of 2022 from Iran to Yemen. It was intercepted by Al-Qaeda. Another one happened from Iran through their intermediaries going into Heathrow, and it was intercepted by the London authorities. I believe it was going to Hezbollah agents. And we now have this open border in the U.S. where at least 15,000 Iranians have infiltrated, according to the Customs and Border Patrol's unofficial assessment. And any one of them could be Hezbollah agents, and you could easily move uranium into the country, build a dirty bomb in situ, and knock out an American or European city doing it that way.
Yeah. Very, very worrying, I think, indeed. And of course, you know, we know nuclear and North Korea has got advanced. They can put a warhead, or so we're told, I believe, a nuclear warhead on a missile now. So it's only a matter of time if Iran hasn't already got that technology, I think. Very, very dangerous situation. Brandon, let's move on and let's talk about your article that you wrote where you basically declared that America's greatest enemy is not China or Russia, but all of the debt that it's built up. Tell us about that article and what you meant.
Yeah. So basically, you know, the U.S. has been able to spend the way that it has for the last 50 years with wanton abandon, largely because our currency, the U.S. dollar, is the primary world reserve currency. We have a Federal Reserve that can just print money as needed. And furthermore, we basically, because oil is traded mostly by the dollar, that gives us a lot of leverage. And basically, we can do what we want with our currency, and the rest of the world has to just deal with it. The people that we owe money to are the debtors. They basically have to just deal with it, and they're okay with it because they figure, well, the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency. It's the most potent currency in the world. So in my article, I was looking at what happens if our debt becomes so burdensome, which it already is, that basically the rest of the world, like, say, these BRICS countries led by China and Russia, say, you know what, we're going to create our own reserve currency as an alternate reserve currency to America, and we're going to start getting many more countries to start using our reserve currency over the dollar, partly because the rest of the world is now fearing how America has weaponized the dollar in terms of doing these sanctions that you mentioned on countries. And so that once we lose that reserve currency status as the primary reserve currency, we can't print money the way we used to. Suddenly our debt becomes very real and we can't pay it back. And the whole system goes down like the Weimar Republic.
Yeah. And I've been talking about this on this show for quite some time now. I guess it's a double-edged sword, though, isn't it? Because I think America would be a very, very dangerous country, actually, if the economy does collapse. And I think China and Russia, America's adversaries, must be aware of that, particularly when you come to other BRICS countries like India, which is kind of, they don't particularly get on with China very well, even if they are in the BRICS. So it's not clear. And I've had analysts on the show here which have talked about the fact that it's not even a done deal, this whole BRICS thing, at the moment. The threat is there. I mean, I guess my question to you is, how likely do you think it is that these BRICS countries are going to start the de-dollarization of the world economy? Or do you think they're going to be more cautious?
Well, I mean, they are already starting the de-dollarization. It's a very slow trickle. But as I say in the article, and I'm quoting from Lawrence of Arabia and the 2012 film Prometheus when I say this, but big things have small beginnings. And what we are seeing now is Russia and China in particular are recognizing that they don't think they can rely on the U.S. dollar. They're recognizing that it is a potential point of weakness, actually, they can exploit. And if they can, you know, put a dent in the dollar's dominance, that's enough to weaken the United States. Do they realize that economically wounded America is a dangerous country? I don't know if they really realize that. I don't know if they're as attenuated to that. But you're right. I mean, it could get very dicey. Any country is going to be a dangerous country when it loses its economic power.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I mean, the other, I guess, incentive for these BRICS countries is the fact that America, the Biden administration, really shot themselves in the foot when they stole that $300 billion of Russian dollar reserves. I mean, you know, if you want to kind of say to people, look, this whole system that you're invested in, you know, give us your money, it's safe. If you want to undermine that, there's no better way to do it than to steal $300 billion from that system. So, you know, really dodgy stuff, I think, from the Biden administration there. Brandon, thank you so much for coming on the Freeman Report. You're welcome back anytime. So please do come back soon.
Will do. Yep.
Thank you, Brandon. Yep. Right. Okay. We're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, I'll be welcoming back Raja Mir. He is a member of the People's Alliance of Oldham, and he is a prospective candidate for Oldham West and Royton in the general election. We're going to be talking all about the politics, the local elections coming up in the UK, which could be really, really important, actually, in this general election year. So don't go anywhere. Stay right where you are. You can get a cup of tea, but that's about it. Don't go anywhere else. Right here on TNT.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was going to make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like Latoya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
Latoya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Meet Norm. He lives with anxiety. But with the help of this latest innovation from Be Normal, he can be normal, just like everyone else. With the swipe of a finger, you can project happiness. confidence. Machismo. Why settle for being real when you can be normal? The Normal Maker. New from Be Normal. This item doesn't really work because there's no such thing as normal. We're all different. What we like, how our brains work. In fact, 1 in 5 of us live with mental illness. Don't filter who you are. Start by talking to someone you trust. And remember, there is no normal.
The Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right. Well, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome back to the Freeman Report. He has been on before, Raja Mia. Last time he was on, we had a really good conversation. I think he's a very brave man. Some of the work that he's done on exposing the corruption around grooming gangs has definitely put his life in danger, but he's stuck with it. He's determined to make a difference around the Manchester area. So welcome back to the Freeman Report, Raja.
Thanks for having me, James. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Roger, let's start with the Oldham Council, because you put a really interesting post out on X recently where you talked about the fact that Labour there, they run the council, but their power is diminishing and they've gone from having 47 of the 60 seats in the council to now they've only got a majority of one, so 31 seats. What is going on in the area? And do you think, obviously, we've got the local elections coming up, do you think we could see them lose control of the council?
5 years relentless campaigning is what's going on, educating an electorate and coordinating the opposition, inspiring the opposition, bullying the opposition sometimes into doing the right thing. And what we've now got is a Labour Party. I mean, this is a Labour Party controlled town, always has been, and they are on the brink of losing control of the council. They will lose control of the council. And you've got to understand, this is contrary to the national trend where Labour are doing better and better and better and taking control of more councils. And the reason why, James, the reason why is, in the end, we've educated an electorate. We've built a cross-community coalition of people who all agree, as much as they disagree on many things, we all agree on a number of things. The corruption in this town needs to be investigated. The books need to be opened up. The grooming gang, a public inquiry needs to be conducted, because it's now very, very clear. Andy Burns' report proved it. Maggie Oliver confirmed it. There has been a cover-up, regardless of the language they use. People knew what was going on. Those in authority knew what was going on and kept it from the public. And that, in its simplest definition, is what a cover-up is. And people have had enough, and we've led a campaign where people have found their courage. They're not scared of being branded racist. They're not, you know, they know my people in my town know they're not racist. You know, caring about children doesn't make anyone racist. And they have become politically astute. We've had, you know, 2 years ago, we took out a lady called Arud Shah in a seat in Chadderton South. Chadderton South had never gone switch sides. We got it to switch to Conservative. You know, and we went out and campaigned and we got it to switch to Conservative because the Conservative candidate at the time was the most viable alternative. And the people went with us and voted. Last year in Royton South, we defeated Amanda Chadderton, the next leader of the council, in a ward that had always been Labour. And again, because we went out, campaigned the old-fashioned way, had conversations on doorsteps with people and looked people in the eye, and we said, what sort of town do you want to live in? And people went with us. People came on that journey with us, and that's why they're now down to a majority of one.
What party then is, I mean, the other councillors, is that the Conservatives? Or, you know, what's the composition of the council in terms of parties?
The main opposition is the Liberal Democrats, and then you've got the Conservatives and various independents in what, you know, in combinations. Now, some of them we can work with, some of them I struggle with, James, I'll be honest with you. Some of them I struggle with, but it isn't where they are that worries me. It's we have a responsibility. The way I've approached this is, people like me have a responsibility to engage with whoever is elected and try and take them on a journey. So if they represent a minority interest group, it's to try and inspire them and encourage them to represent a wider demographic. And sometimes we win, sometimes we're losing. Now, there are some groups, particularly as a consequence of the conflict in Gaza, the October events, and you've seen yourselves, your viewers will have seen themselves, the way in which the Labour Party has lost support amongst the Muslim voters. Now, there are groups emerging who are latching onto that, and I question their motives. And I question where it'll take us and whether that's better for the betterment of our democracy or it takes us into a dark place. But I'll tell you what, if we don't engage with those people, it will take us into a dark place.
Yeah, and this is why I asked you that question, because I think, you know, I don't know the composition of every council, but I'm thinking if it was the Conservatives that were in opposition, then that might be a problem, because I think their vote is going to collapse. I think yes. That's baked in already. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting, the Liberal Democrats there. What about George Galloway's party? Are you expecting them to put councillors up?
No, they haven't. What they've done is they've stayed out of Oldham in terms of the local council elections. There are certain candidates who are standing aligned with George Galloway's Workers' Party, but they're not standing as Workers' Party candidates. To give George credit, he's looked at Oldham and recognised that a lot of work has took place, and him coming along now, he would upset, you know, he's not palatable everywhere, is he? And he appeals to one demographic more than others. I think that's very clear from the analysis of Rochdale. The Muslims went and flooded and voted for him, and the other communities didn't as much, regardless of him, you know, pushing his socialist credentials. That hasn't happened. Now, he's put up candidates in Rochdale. He's put up white candidates in Rochdale, such as Billy, who's a very well-respected, well, as far as I'm concerned, a very well-respected campaigner on the CSE stuff, has been doing it for a long time, because he himself was abused when he was a young man. So, you know, they are trying. Now, they've not put anyone up in Oldham, and I think it's a good thing they've not put anyone in Oldham. And I'm hoping that come the general election, that this pragmatism continues and they'll leave Oldham West alone, because the only thing they'll do in Oldham West, if they put up a candidate, is split the vote and allow Labour to win. We've built up a coalition. It's took us 5 years. And the last thing we want is someone to come in meddling in our town without understanding what's gone on.
Yeah, exactly. And thing is, though, Raj, I think you should have some confidence there, because that is how you win elections, is by speaking to people, getting in front of them. And you can't just do that in a few weeks or a few months before the election. You need to put in the hard work. You know that. You've been doing this for a very, very long time. Can I just ask, though, the conflict in Gaza has had a big impact on UK politics. Arguably, it's one of the reasons why George Galloway has been able to get in Rochdale. How much of an impact has it had, or do you expect it to have, on the local elections coming up?
It already has in my town. The two Labour councillors resigned right at the end, just before the nominations went in for the local elections. And having spent time campaigning on the ground, I think the Muslim communities are very, very interesting. Once you go closer and examine what's taking place, it will be interesting to see if Labour's vote holds in our communities, in the communities I come from, and if it does, who still supports them. Because I'm looking at it and I'm speaking to people on the ground, and we are getting back that the older sort of traditional Labour voters from the South Asian communities will continue to vote Labour. It's a younger demographic who have turned against them and turned very strongly against them. Now, will they come out and vote, or will they just, you know, hide behind a keyboard like so many of the younger generation do and not have an impact on the election? So from using my analysis sort of interest, I'm very, very much looking forward to seeing the breakdown of the Labour vote and whether they hold the vote. Because we're talking about the Labour Party here. The Labour Party, 90% or so of the people from Muslim backgrounds across Greater Manchester would go and vote Labour. And I'm very, very much interested to see whether they, you know, what sort of percentage of the vote they hold.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for me with local elections is it's all about the turnout, because traditionally the turnout is what 20-30% in a lot 30%. Of places.
Yeah. The Asian wars have a higher turnout, James. Unfortunately, I think my experience, my understanding, my position is it's linked to postal votes and postal vote harvesting. So in the Asian areas, the turnout is much higher and has been much higher always.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to the general election. Obviously, you're a prospective candidate in that. You're planning to run in Oldham West and Royton. What are the politics there for you? Because I think for the general election as a whole, at the moment anyway, there's still a long way to go. We don't even know when the election is going to take place. We just know some point this year. But at the moment, you know, the two topics that everyone's talking about are immigration and the economy. Is that the same where you are? Do you expect those two issues to be the biggest topics?
Not the biggest topics, but obviously they are strong topics where I have got to have a position on and have got to have a sensible position on to reinforce. I don't think anyone new is going to vote for me because of my position on immigration and economics. But as long as I've got a sensible position on both, then I should be okay. The trigger points in a town such as mine is to do with the corruption, is to do with the grooming gangs, is to do with the lack of representation, the apathy, the feeling of betrayal, the feeling of, you know, you don't care about us the same as you care about other people. That is what's going to win the election in Oldham. And that's what we'll fight the election in Oldham. And the rest of our policies will, of course, be sensible. You look at the immigration stuff, James, and the conversations I have in the Muslim communities, in the African Caribbean communities, are exactly the same as the conversations in the white working class communities. The liberal elites, as I describe them, would like to try and divide us, but actually we're all affected by immigration in the same way, in terms of, you know, lack of housing, lack of school places, a feeling that people are taking advantage of our democracy. And those views are legitimate views to hold. Now, we've looked towards the Conservative government and they've failed. You know, they've failed to do what a Conservative government should have done easier. You know, no one expects the Labour government to really stop the boats or have a more stern position on immigration, because Labour's track record isn't that. You know, if you go back to Tony Blair's years, and one of the pivotal moments was during of how this country's demographic change was under Labour's tenure. You know, so I don't think anyone believes Labour can be trusted with immigration. Unfortunately, the Conservatives have failed on an issue that really is theirs to grab hold of and deliver on.
Now, Raja, you talked about young people. I think you're really engaging. I can see you connecting with young people. What are you doing to encourage them and try and motivate them to come out to vote? Because, you know, we hear lots about this. In Wales, for example, they've made it, and I think in Scotland as well, that 16-year-olds can come out to vote in Welsh elections. But the reality is, on election day, the sun's shining, or, you know, there's something going on somewhere and people just don't come out and turn out to vote. What are you doing to try and motivate young people to come out to vote?
You make sure that they understand it's about them and they can make a difference, and politics is also for them. Unfortunately, when we speak to people, James, on the doorsteps, when we speak to people, young and old, the apathy has got nothing to do with age. The apathy is to do with a combination of not understanding the democratic process. For instance, you know, come to a town like mine, and most people, not most is wrong, but too many people do not understand the difference between a council election and a general election, never mind the mayoral elections, you know, where the voting system is very different. And then the second thing is the trust in politicians is at an all-time low, particularly in areas where politicians are parachuted in, career politicians, people who have no understanding of the communities that they will represent, who won't be able to walk around a community or a town without an A to Z or Google Maps or whatever the modern day version is. And it's about having candidates across the board that represent the people that they're trying to get elected by. And that sadly has gone away. And that connection has gone in too many places, particularly along amongst the big mainstream parties. You've seen it. You've seen how they're parachuted in. You've seen, you know, and that has had a damaging effect in our communities.
Absolutely.
Roger. People need people that look like them. People need people that look like them, talk like them, care about them, and they'll come out to vote.
Now, Roger, I think you're a great candidate, but I know how difficult it is in general elections when you're up against the main political parties that have, you know, for decades, if not hundreds of years, they've been building up their local infrastructure. They've got lots of data. They've got lots of money. So I know how important it is to get help. Anybody who's watching this now and thinks, I like this guy, I want to help him, where do they go? Where, you know, whether it's delivering leaflets, how do they get...
Just go to my Twitter page, or rajamir.com is the email. You can contact me and any help will be gladly appreciated. Thank you. Thank you, James.
Fantastic. If you do live in the Oldham area, please do get in touch. I think Raja is a great candidate. He's definitely down to earth. He's one of us, not one of these career politicians. So good luck to Raja.
Thank you.
We'll have to get you back on some point before the local elections or just after. But good luck in that and good luck with your campaign for the general election. Raja Mir, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Right, that's me for today. I'll be back tomorrow to do it all over again, but don't go anywhere because we've got more great shows coming up right here on TNT.